Rory McIlroy was leading the 2025 U.S. Masters Golf Tournament by 2 strokes after 3 rounds. Was his ultimate victory a sure thing? How predictive is a lead after 3 rounds of a golf tournament for victory after the 4th round? In today's episode of Stats and Stories, we hit the links to explore outcomes in professional golf tournaments, along with addressing whether golf handicaps make for fair comparisons between golfers. I'm John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. I'm joined in the studio by Rosemary Pennington from the Department of Media Journalism and Film. Our guest today is Dr. Lawrence Cooper, Emeritus Alumni Distinguished Professor of Biostatistics, School of Public Health, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. His research interests included the development and application of statistical methods for public health studies, particularly environmental, occupational, and women's health, and quantifying health risks from exposure to environmental and workplace hazards. He was also an impactful teacher and mentor, as I can well attest. I met Larry in the early 80s when I was a student in a master's statistical theory class he was teaching. He encouraged me to pursue a PhD in biostatistics, supported my studies as part of an NIH-NIEHS training grant, and was part of my dissertation committee. Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you back here, Larry. It's great to talk. So our today's program, we're going to talk to Larry about one of his other passions, golf. He's an avid golfer and has viewed his passion for golf through the lens of statistics in a recent article in Significance magazine, Predicting Victory in Golf, and in a 2001 Chance article that was titled, Is the USGA Golf Handicap System Equitable? Larry, it's a delight again to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be here. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, how about let's start with just a description of what's the structure of a 4-round golf tournament?
Well, the structure of a 4-round golf tournament, and typically we were studying the major golf tournaments. They call them the majors. It's typically 4 rounds of golf. First round starts Thursday, 18 holes, Friday, 18 holes, Saturday, 18 holes, final round, Sunday, 18 holes. And you add up the total strokes for 72 holes, including penalty strokes and whatever, ethically, and you end up with a total score after 72 holes. And if you have the lowest total number of strokes after 72 holes, you win. If you are tied with someone, there's a playoff. Nowadays, the playoffs are either sudden death until somebody beats the other person or other two or three people, or there's a 3-hole playoff. That's the way it works now.
So you, what made you decide to do this study on to figure out if you have a lead at the end of the third day, you could possibly win the tournament outright?
Well, to be honest, I started playing golf when I was a junior in college, and I got really hooked. And I got hooked by Arnold Palmer, who is my all-time favorite golfer. But I've always watched the majors every year, starting in 1960. And I've always wondered this question about what happens when you, because I've played golf in a lot of tournaments myself, and I have choked a lot of times. And so, golf is a very frustrating sport because there's no defense. Okay. They're not playing defense again. You're there, the ball sitting there very quietly. You have a club, there's a hole, and it's between your ears. And so I've always wondered, what does it take to hold a lead after 3 rounds in a major golf tournament for both men and for women? And so that's why I was really interested in this, in doing this with my wife, Sandy.
So can you tell us a little bit about the data set that you harvested for this exploration?
Yeah, the data set, we looked at 25 years of golf from the year 2000 through 2024. And we decided to look at that era because we considered that to be the modern era of golf, where there was many more great players having the potential to win and much better equipment. So these players now are driving the ball 50 yards, 75 yards further than they used to in the 70s and the 80s. And so we did 25 years of data. We looked at 4 men's majors, Masters, PGA, US Open, British Open, and four women's majors, Chevron, PGA, US Open, and British Open. So that was the data that we got. And we used Wikipedia and other golf-related websites to get the data.
Now, I'm going to admit to not playing or really understanding golf as a sport. So why choose the sort of status of where a player is at the end of round three and not say whether they're in the lead after the first round?
Because most of these tournaments, the major pressure is in the last round. Usually there's several people that are, you know, in the lead or very close to the lead. And I've just always been curious of the pressure of the final round is why I wanted to look at that more than anything else. And that's what most people, when they, people that watch it on TV, very often they just put on the TV for the final round. And that's where the pressure is, let me tell you.
You know, I pulled up some of the top 15 or so, you know, the scores of the last of the Masters when I was looking at this, just as a little just fun to look at the data. And I realized that, you know, while Rory McIlroy was leading after three rounds, there was someone that was two strokes behind him, and the person two strokes behind him ended up being kind of eighth, you know, tied for fifth ultimately, but just really fell out of the lead. And it was that, like, that pressure that last round really can come back and haunt you.
Oh yeah. And if you watched that Masters in 2025, there was incredible pressure on Rory because, as you know, he had never won the Masters. He had tried 17 years in a row to win the Masters. And he actually, I think in 2008, had a four-stroke lead and shot 80 in the final round. But the last round that I watched the Masters this year was probably one of the most exciting final rounds I've ever seen in any major golf tournament. It fluctuated back and forth. Rory was behind, he was ahead, he was behind, he was ahead, he was behind. And he finally ended up, you know, missing a short putt on the 18th hole to go into a playoff with Justin Rose, and he won the playoff. And Sandy and I were so excited because Rory's always been our favorite golfer.
So, yeah, you mentioned this. You looked at kind of the likelihood that they would win the tournament given a certain size of a lead.
Yes.
And I was surprised at the number of times a four-stroke lead didn't hold up.
Yeah.
I think in the British Open, it was, I don't know, maybe two of five times the person with a four-stroke lead would win. But in seven of 17 overall, I was just really, that really ran counter to what I would have expected.
Yeah, I felt with this paper that some of the results made a lot of sense. For example, the bigger your lead, the better your chance of winning, okay? Like there, you could have a one-stroke lead, a two-stroke lead, a three-stroke lead, a four-stroke lead, or five or more stroke lead. And it was clear for both the men and women that it was basically a monotonic relationship statistically, that the bigger the lead you had, the more likely it was that you were going to win, okay? And also, the bigger the lead, the rarer it was. So in other words, it was the overall, it was five-stroke leads are clearly much more rare than one-stroke leads. So a lot of that stuff made sense, you know, for me. I expected that to happen.
So what did you see that you didn't expect to happen?
Well, I think what was really interesting that I didn't really expect to happen was I was curious, and Sandy and I were curious about which major tournaments was it harder to hold the lead in the final round than other ones. And so, for example, for the men, if you had at least a one-stroke lead after three rounds, it was much harder to hold that lead in the U.S. Open and the British Open than it was in the Masters and the PGA. And I think my philosophy that what the reason for that was is that when you're playing to get a title representing your country, there's a lot more pressure. Mm. And so that made a lot of sense to me. And for the women, it was harder to hold the lead of at least one stroke in the Chevron and the U.S. Open. But the amazing consistent thing about this was that for both men and women, it was hardest to hold the lead in the U.S. Open, like 34%, something like that. And it was very consistent.
Yeah, I was curious about kind of size of lead things. Because, you know, there's if you're only up by one, you feel like I'm effectively tied. Yeah,
that's
correct. It's not like it's like we're all starting from there. But if you're you know, if you're up by two, you maybe start to get a little more relaxed. You know, the psyche of the sort of the psychology of kind of a lead as you go into a last round of competition. Is there a place where you're kind of overly confident or not feeling the same pressure? I was just thinking, you know, are there other things that you've thought about in terms of playing out in the performance in that last round?
Yes, I that's exactly right. I agree, but I still, even with a two-shot lead, no guarantee, trust me. The other interesting thing was, the other thing I felt I never expected either was for both men and women, over all of the majors that they played, if you had at least a one-stroke lead, it was pretty much like a 43% chance that you would win for both men and for women. So that was unexpected to me, too. It was very consistent. You know, men and women, hardest to hold the lead in the U.S. Open. For men and women, 43% overall chance of winning with at least a one-shot lead. So those findings I felt were interesting to me.
You know, I was curious if there were cases of some golfers that were, you know, round, they were ahead the whole tournament, you know, leading after one, leading after two, leading after three, leading after four. Were there any, did that ever occur in your data set? Do you happen to know?
No, but I am aware of some horrible final round chokes that are unbelievable.
John and I would both like to hear more about that.
Well, some golfers I really rooted for, like I said, I root for Rory McIlroy. He had a four-stroke lead and won Masters going into the final round, and he lost, shot 80. That was very disappointing. Phil, you know who Phil Mickelson is? Have you heard of Phil Mickelson?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the great thing about Rory winning this year was he became the sixth golfer to have won all four majors, right? So that was incredible pressure for him to come through to do that. He's been trying for 17 years. Phil Mickelson has never won the U.S. Open. And in 2006, he was playing the final round, came to the 18th hole, and all he needed was a par. He hits his drive way left in the woods, hits his next shot, hits a scorer's tent.
Oh,
I still remember, gets a free drop, hits it in the bunker by the green into a fried egg lie, takes two to get it out of the bunker, makes a double bogey and loses. That was horrible. I watched that.
Oh.
The worst one ever, though, that was not in my data set was the British Open in 1999. Have you ever heard of the one John Vandeveld?
I have not.
Okay. John Vandeveld was a French professional golfer. The last professional golfer before winning won the British Open was 1907. So Vandeveld had a three-shot lead standing on the tee of the 18th hole at Carnoustie. And I have actually played that course. The 18th hole is not a very hard par four. It's fairly straightforward. There's just a lot of trouble on the right side, a lot of really heavy grass. And there's a burn, they call a little creek in front of the green. So I still remember it vividly. On the tee, all he had to do was just take like a iron and just bump it out 150 yards off the tee, hit another 150 yards, just hit a wedge on the green. Even if he makes a double bogey, he wins. He takes a driver out. Uh-oh. The announcers are saying, I can't believe this. So he hits his driver. He hits a big slice. It goes out to the right, but it lands on a little island, sort of. So he, I mean, his ball could have been in like 8 feet high rough, okay? So it lands on a little island. So he gets up there, and the announcers say, just wedge it back to the fairway and hit it on the green. So he takes a four iron. He hits a really bad slice. It hits in the stands by the green, kicks back into 6 foot high rough. Okay, but he's there in two. All he has to do is chip it back onto the fairway and just hit it on the green. So he decides instead to try to hit it toward the green. He's about 50 yards from the green, but there's a little creek just short of the green. So he hits it, it goes in the creek. Okay. So he takes a drop from the creek into the heavy rough and hits it into the bunker. Okay. Oh. Finally hits it on the green, makes a putt for a triple bogey, goes into a three-hole playoff and loses. So that was my worst experience ever watching a golf tournament, you know? So that's what I remember, some of the worst things in my life that I've seen watching golf, you know? I've done it myself, so I feel much sympathy, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Larry Cooper about golf. Yeah, Larry, just to change gears a little bit, I was surprised at some of the factors that were involved in defining a golf handicap. You know,
yes.
Can you explain how a golf handicap is constructed and how it's used?
Yes, I can try to do that. The paper that we wrote in 2001 got an incredible amount of publicity. When it was published, it got written up in Newsweek. So in the front part of Newsweek, there was a woman wrote a short article entitled "Why You Lose." And in the article, it said, if you're a high handicap golfer, you don't get enough strokes when you're competing against a better golfer. And she contacted the United States Golf Association, and they refused to acknowledge that there was a problem. Okay. So anyhow, the way a golf handicap is constructed is in the following way. Okay. Typically, a golfer plays, say, typically they like to have you post about 20 scores. So let's say a golfer, like, let's say I'm playing at the University of North Carolina golf course and I shoot 84. I go in the clubhouse and I write down under my name 84. Then the next round I play, I write down another score. Typically, if you get up to 20 scores, okay, they will send every month, the club that you're a member of will send your scores in to the United States Golf Association. And they will compute what's called a handicap index. Now, the way that's computed is the following. You take a score, and the score is adjusted for two things, the course rating. And the course rating is sort of like what would be the average score that a scratch golfer, a really good golfer, would shoot on this course. So a course rating is something like maybe 72, something like 72.2 or something like that. It also has what's called a slope rating. A slope rating is a measure of a typical course that like a non-professional golfer would play. And so it's like an average course would have a slope rating of 113. If it's harder, it can go up to 155, or if it's easier, it can go down to 55. So you take the handicap index is made up as a function of the course rating and the slope rating in your score. You put those in and you get what's called a handicap differential. Okay. So let's say for me, I have 20 handicap differentials. Okay. The way the handicap index is computed, they take the lowest 10 of those 20 handicap differentials. That's what they did back in 2001. Now they take the lowest 8. Okay. Then they basically take the average of those. So my handicap index would be an average of my lowest 10 handicap differentials. Okay. So I would have that number. Let's say it might be 15.5. Then I go try to play a golf course. I go in the clubhouse and let's say I'm going to play somebody else in a tournament. I tell the pro what tees I'm going to play, and I say my handicap index is 15.5. There's a formula that translates that into a number of strokes. So let's say I get 12 strokes. So whatever score I shoot, I would at the end subtract off 12, and that would be my net score. So my gross score minus my handicap of 12 would be my net score. So that's the way it works.
So what are handicaps used for?
Well, they're used to try to make a match equitable between two golfers. Like, let's say I'm a good golfer and I was playing a golfer.
Me, I'm a bad golfer.
Okay, not very good. Okay, so let's say in our paper we used funny names. We had one golfer who was a good golfer was called Steady Eddie.
Yeah.
Okay. And the high handicap golfer was called Wild Willie. So let's say Wild Willie is playing Steady Eddie in a match. Okay. So let's say Steady Eddie shoots 80 and has a 6-stroke handicap. So his net score would be 74. But let's say Wild Willie shot 90. But his handicap was 17. So 90 minus 17 would be 73. He would win because the net score of 73 is lower than the net score of 74. So the idea of the handicap system was to make the two, like make Steady Eddie and Wild Willie have the same chance of winning, but they don't because of the fact they take the lowest 10 handicap differentials. So we can go, if you want to go into that now, why?
Yeah, and part of this is, you know, can you talk as part of Steady Eddie and Wild Willie, are you talking also about kind of consistency of how they play?
That's exactly right. The consistency is exactly right. The basic idea is Wild, when we did our paper, we went out and got an incredible amount of data about how variable golfers are relative to their handicap index. And it turned out that the Wild Willies are way more variable in the scores they shoot than our Steady Eddies, way more variable. So if you think about it statistically, the idea of a handicap, the reason the United States Golf Association wanted to use the lowest 10 scores or handicap differentials was to look at the potential that golfers had. The problem is if you have a distribution that's much more spread out, which it would be for Wild Willies, their lowest 10 would be much farther away from where their typical scores are. And that was the whole basic idea of why there was a bias, because Wild Willies would not be getting enough strokes because he would be being penalized for being more variable. So his lowest 10 would be much farther away from what he typically does than Steady Eddie. And so there was incredible bias, and you can prove it and show that a lot of times, Steady Eddie would have a 2/3 chance of winning when he was playing Wild Willie. That was the whole idea of the thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's something I didn't realize this, and I'm curious how the golfing associations responded to this, because you're basically saying, hey, you're telling us this is making it fair, but ultimately what you're doing is rewarding the more consistent golfer with the way you've currently
and
done
what they still are. They're still doing it. They now
it's even
take
worse now, isn't it? With 8, doesn't that make
it
worse?
Yeah, they take the lowest 8 now instead of the lowest 10. They changed it recently. Their whole argument was there should be a bonus for excellence. That's their quote. There should be a bonus for excellence. But it's really not fair when Wild Willie's playing Steady Eddie. But I'll give you one other interesting thing. I've played in a lot of golf tournaments in my life, okay? And what's interesting is very often a wild Willie wins the golf tournament. And what, you know why? Because if you have a lot of wild Willies in a golf tournament, the chances are high because of the variability that at least one of them will have an incredibly great round, and that usually wins. So Wild Willie usually has an advantage over Steady Eddie in, if there's a big tournament with a lot of wild Willies. It's sort of funny, you know.
One of the things I just looked at the 2025 Masters, and I was looking at the variability of round across rounds within each within each player, and it was interesting that the top two finishers had more variability in their four rounds than others from that group.
Right.
And, you know, actually they had the top two highest standard deviations among the top 15 or so finishers.
Exactly, yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. So it's that ability to, you know, always have a great recovery if you've had a bad round that seems to be a...
You know what it is? It's the classic regression to the mean. When you shoot, you know, when you shoot 62, I am guaranteeing you are going to regress to the mean in the next round. You know what I'm saying? Regression to the mean is the penalty we all have to live with. You know that? You know what I'm saying?
So I'm going to ask you, as you're watching golf tournaments now, how comfortable are you going to be when you see someone like Rory McIlroy or someone else you're rooting for going into the final round with a lead? How comfortable are you going to be with them potentially winning?
I guess it depends on the size of the lead. I would feel really comfortable if they had a 4 or 5 shot lead, but a 1 shot lead. The thing now, I think even now it's like, there's so many fabulous golfers now, you know, in the world. I mean, if you look at pro tournaments now, there's like, I would imagine there's 30 or 40 people teeing off that could win a professional golf tournament now. If you go back in the 60s and the 70s, you know, where Jack Nicklaus was fabulous and Arnold Palmer was fabulous, there weren't that many players that could win a major tournament that were really a factor, maybe 5, maybe 7, 8, something like that. Now there's 30, 40 of them could win teeing off. There's so many good, fabulous golfers now, you know, just from all over the world. I mean, you know, just from all over the world, Norway, Sweden, Spain, playing from everywhere in the world are fabulous.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
I'm telling you what, I will never forget this. And I really, it's meant incredible to me to be able to do it. I really am. I will never forget it. It's one of the highlights that I've ever had. It really means an incredible amount to me. You know, thank you so much.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on our program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. Be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.